The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
This is Mike Consul. Welcome to the program. My guest is founder and CEO of Ready Spaces. His name is John Zimmerman. Ready Spaces is a warehouse storage enterprise. It was founded in 2013, and its purpose is to make it easier for small businesses to grow. John Zimmerman has more than 20 years experience in the self-storage business, and this new take on storage for startups, the need warehousing, is in full force these days. In fact, the company just recently raised a $16.2 million funding round. And John joins me from, where are you, John? What city are you in?
I am just north of San Francisco, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Mike, for having me.
You're in my part of the world, here in Northern California. Okay, well, we could have even done this in person, but it's better to do it through Zencastr. So here we are. You know, let's talk about this industry. Let's start with co-warehousing, because my understanding is from our chit-chat before I started recording, co-warehousing dates back some, that is what Ready Spaces does and some other organizations do. Co-warehousing dates back, I think you said, to 1997. Tell us about co-warehousing. What is it, and why did it come into being?
That's a great question. And let me clarify, I got into it in 1997. I am not suggesting that others haven't. And as a matter of fact, there are other players, you know, in this industry, but they're very local. There's no one that we know of, maybe a competitor to now, that is doing it on a national and certainly international level in which we are at Ready Spaces. The real quick version is in 1997, I was closing a show. Let me really back up. And when I say closing a show, I was a theater producer before all of this real estate stuff. And I was literally putting props and costumes into a self-storage facility and recognized the potential to make a lot of money in the self-storage world. So I literally called one of my actress's husbands, who was in the trucking business. He had an empty warehouse. I knew nothing of the self-storage business, but I was intrigued. And I called him, and I met with him, and I said, hey, you have this empty warehouse. Let me go fill it up, and we'll be partners. And he said, great. Go do it. So I literally went around to all the self-storage facilities in the area. And I said, I'm not going to compete with you because my units are going to be 500 square feet and up. And anybody who, you know, calls me who needs small traditional self-storage space, I'll send to you. And anyone who needs big space that you can't handle yourself, then send to me. And in, I think, 3 months, I filled 60,000 square feet in West Oakland. And that business was great and sort of trucking along. Everything dramatically changes when the share economy hits and the Airbnbs and the Ubers, but I'll get there. Mm-hmm. So I open up what is called alternative storage and warehousing, and all I have are mostly small businesses that probably pretty much have sort of dead storage is what their needs are at the time. sometimes they would need a forklift, and we happen to have a forklift on site. So the genesis of Ready Spaces, its evolution, really started back in 1997, 98. And then I had the opportunity in 2001 to build my own traditional self-storage facility because it was just a booming market here in the Bay Area. So I built a traditional 800-unit self-storage facility. I ended up really focusing in on that business because, you know, it was sizable. It's right down the street from the Oakland Coliseum. And there was always this little sideline business of mine called alternative storage and warehousing. In 2005, I had an opportunity to sell this self-storage facility of mine. And in doing so, I really started to hone in and recognize the overwhelming demand there was, even in my self-storage facility with small little units. Like a law firm, for example, needed ultimately 1,000 square feet. And what they ended up doing, because I didn't have it at the time, is they would rent 5 10 by 20s. And if you add up 5 10 by 20s, it's 1,000 square feet. So we might as well put them in one unit. So it really goes back to what I initially started with alternative storage and warehousing. And I really have never looked back. After 2005, having the opportunity to sell this, you know, traditional self-storage facility, I really started to look back at this little sideline business of mine and realize that there is tremendous demand, and also there's no real competition. I mean, the self-storage industry is a behemoth.
It's been booming for a long time.
It's been booming for a long, long time. It's publicly traded. I mean, it is no longer, when I got in, a sort of mom and pop business. And that's the way it was. When you own one, let's face it, it's a mom and pop business. Right now, that industry is just, you know, continuously being gobbled up by, you know, be it Wall Street or private equity or whoever, or, you know, just the companies that are already public. So I like this other industry a lot more, and I could tell you why. First and foremost, is I wasn't chasing money. In the self-storage business, you have so many people, or at least where we were, there were so many people that just weren't paying rent. I think I had at one point 400 customers out of 800 units, and I had a 25% delinquency. So you are constantly chasing money, constantly having auctions, and
yeah, you realize they made an entire program out of this, John. There's a TV program where people bid, they auction off the space, and then they open it up, and you get, you know, whatever. You don't even know, it's a pig and a poke, I suppose you could say, using an old phrase. And I mean, it's that dramatic. It's, you know, what's behind door number two, and
indeed,
people pay money.
Indeed, as a matter of fact, Storage Wars contacted me. When I and another partner, my original partner, happened to have a unit that was, I think, 80,000 square feet in a building he owned. So this was a guy for 30 years in the demolition business, and he collected everything before he demolished buildings, and he had some real treasures. And so Storage Wars heard about what we had, came up and said, we want to do an entire season on you because there are some incredible things in this big facility. And, you know, it ultimately didn't work out because they needed us to put everything on hold for about a year before they could get ready to shoot all these multiple episodes. And we just said, look, you know, we love the idea, but we need the space back. And so we had this enormous 3-week auction. Like every weekend, we'd have to auction this stuff off. And again, there were some real treasures, but mostly, and I would say 95% of the time, being, you know, on the reality side of Storage Wars, not, you know, made for TV. The reality is most of it's sort of junky. And all you want in the self-storage world is to get rid of it so you could go turn around and rent or, you know, rent the unit. So there's
now, co-warehousing, they're paying you in advance, right? They're paying in advance for the month or the, well, they're signing a lease for, but they're paying monthly.
They are paying monthly. And again, that is one of the things I took away from the self-storage business is that the convenience of being able to come in without financials, because again, mostly small businesses would need to go into, you know, be at 1,000 square feet and you'd have to commit to a 3 to 5 year lease and have the financials to back you up. So it's very convenient for especially small businesses and startups to come rolling in and sign up. You know, you're basically paying first month and last month. I think in many locations now we have sort of a 3 month minimum, but it's a serious.
What's your size minimum? What is the smallest size a person or a company, a business can rent?
You know, probably 250 square feet is about the smallest size. And again, we adapt to the demands of what we call our members, you would call customers. And, you know, when people need smaller space, and because we're so flexible, we literally could build, we could take a bigger unit and cut it up into, we could take a 1,000 square foot unit and cut it up into quarters, you know, within a day or two.
Right. Right. It's kind of like Legos. I mean, you can move walls around and
you got
it. And so on. So why is it needed? Why is it needed? You said you're in the business to help businesses.
Yeah.
Why is it needed?
Well,
I mean, it's kind of implicit in what you said, but I just want you to go ahead and summarize it.
Certainly, certainly. Well, let's start with this new terminology called the Great Resignation. And you know, the Great Resignation gives you some idea of what's happening in this incredible economic shift in which we're currently in. So you've got millions of people saying, I don't want to go back to work for someone. And at the same time, and I'm about to quote the New York Times article that, why is my phone off? But I think I know it well enough. You had 4.3 million people apply for business licenses last year, which eclipsed the prior 12 years.
Wow.
So, I mean, and I'll happily send you the article to make sure I got it right. I'm waiting for my phone to pop up to verify it. But nevertheless, so you've got this extraordinary shift in the economy and the workforce. And even though maybe minimum wage is rising to $17, I think a lot of people see the writing on the wall if you're in the restaurant business, if you're in the retail business, if you're in the office space business, that those things are so dramatically shifted. We're not sure what those are going to look like.
Yeah.
And most jobs that are out there of the 9 million jobs that need to be filled are fairly low paying jobs still. So
and wages are going, I mean, and wages have been going up and they still are having trouble drawing people. Trucking happens to be an example where they pay well. And they're offering, even restaurants are offering signing bonuses, but people are, as you say, as you indicated here, as the New York Times says, they're moving on and deciding, I want to be my own employer.
Yeah. And what's the thrill for myself and Kevin and the whole company is, you know, since Kevin and I, and Kevin Petrovich is my partner and COO, you know, we're serial entrepreneurs and we love to see innovation, creativity, and people saying, you know what, I want to control my own destiny, because that's what we do. So it's a thrill to see our 2,000, almost 2,500 customers, you know, following in sort of our footsteps and to support that in any way we can is really exciting. And if you want to draw back and see even a bigger picture, you know, how do we rebuild this economy, the U.S. economy, through something that's actually traditional and it's the backbone of the United States, small businesses, right? Small businesses employ a majority of the people in this country. It's not the, it's certainly not the corporations.
No, they employ fewer. I mean, the Fortune 500 employs far fewer people today than they did 25 or 50 years ago.
Well,
yeah,
exactly.
Because they can do so much more with less. And the other thing I would say about small business is it really is capitalism. Wall Street's socialism. Okay, there's socialism for Wall Street. There's capitalism for Main Street. So, you know, it is, you have to survive. The government doesn't bail out small businesses. So these are real business people taking risks.
These are real business people taking risks. And we attempt to, you know, lower the barrier as much as possible. A huge barrier for any small business is looking at a 3 to 5 year lease. I mean, that would prevent many from taking that big leap of faith. But at the same time, if we could get you in and it's, you know, you're going to pay a first month and last month's rent, then you could really understand and understand how to budget and move forward and determine, for example, if that 1,000 square feet is the right size for you. You might say, oh, we're a little seasonal. Let's downsize to 300 square feet and get through it. And, oh, look, we're picking up momentum. Now we need 3,000 square feet.
So this is very much like the WeWork of warehousing.
I would say exactly the same, minus all of the negative publicity that WeWork got over the years. But let's clarify, we've always made money. We have a very different model, one of organic growth.
You've never portrayed yourself as a tech company. You've always been a warehousing company.
I would never let SoftBank convince me that I am anything but a warehouse industrial flex person, operator. No, I think that was very misleading and we understood and the house of cards fell. But with that said, WeWork is going to be very successful once they stop growing and, you know, they've got loyal customers, and they'll do fine.
But if you carry an inventory, so WeWork is, you know, it's people sitting, white collar workers in knowledge industry sitting at computers. But you might be a WeWork person who actually has an inventory, and that's why co-warehousing would be needed.
Well said. I would even go further to say that if you're in needing industrial flex, co-work space, you would move in right with us because we all also generally offer office space as well. So if you need a more traditional office, you would move in, and then your whatever product you might have, if it's product based, you would obviously have a warehouse space somewhere in the interior of the building.
So is this a master lease sublease situation, or do you build your own facilities? How does that part of it work?
Yeah, great question. So right now, we are in the process of long-term leasing because the economics seem to make the most sense. And also going back to the whole philosophy in the evolution of the business, I wanted to repurpose old big warehouses. Why did I want to do that? One, there's a carbon footprint issue. Two, there's really no delta or arbitrage in building something ground up. There's probably higher and better demand for growth if you're building something. With that said, I just got pictures today of a space we are moving into, and for the first time ever, it's being built from ground up. We don't own it; we will long term lease it. But generally, it's just driven by economics and competition. I mean, let's just look at what Amazon does to the just general warehouse the general warehouse landscape throughout the country and possibly the world. Not even do they drive up prices, but they're grabbing everything, and be it through Blackstone or Prologis or whatever, and those are also our landlords. It's just a grab right now to get any sort of warehousing. And thankfully, because our properties are more B and C and untraditional design and maybe have 3 or 7 loading docks, we really don't compete with Amazon directly because you know, they're the big behemoth and you can't compete with them. So
yeah, you don't want to, because they will squash you. I mean, or they'll try to.
They'll squash us, but here's the beauty that we move into whatever our buildings are that are, again, if you look on our website, we've got lots of different types of buildings under our Ready Spaces umbrella. But so many of our e-tailers, right, our e-commerce members use Amazon, right? I mean,
right.
You know, Amazon is just part of
Amazon has hammered down the cost of doing business for these people. You know, yeah. WeWork has hammered down the cost for office space and offered that flexibility. Ready Spaces is trying to do that as well now. But, you know, WeWork comes with this host of services. Warehousing is a little bit different, but I'm curious as to, are there services that come with a lease, when a co-warehousing lease?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's first break down the WeWork. I mean, WeWork gave you bagels and beer and internet service. I mean, it's not like they had a whole host of all of these services for you. I mean, we have forklift, you know, we've got loading dogs for you. We've got pallet jacks. We have someone at the front desk who could conceivably receive packages that are coming in. You know, we do have some shared services, but those few things that I just mentioned, along with the fact that self-storage cannot even technically, under its PUC regulation, you can't operate a business at a self-storage facility. Don't get me wrong, people have product there and they might be off-site, but technically, self-storage, you can't run your business. So with us, you can run your business out of your unit. You could have an office space with us and go back into the warehouse section. But the real distinction between self-storage and us is, again, there's no such thing as a forklift that's available at a self-storage facility. There's no loading docks at a self-storage facility.
Right. You don't have semis pulling up.
There's no semis pulling up. And that, I mean, in our Doral, you know, Florida, Miami, Florida area, I think we get 3,000 packages a day. You know, self-storage.
And that's in where? Doral, Florida?
Yeah, you know, yeah. We're about 15 minutes from Miami.
So
that makes us very different. Go ahead.
Typical duration of leases. Now, I think you said that, you know, you'll do leases as short as a few months. How long do leases? What's the longest lease you've done?
Well, believe it or not, we do have Fortune 500 companies with, you know, names you would know. Well, they don't want us to talk about them, but we do have some of those. And they've signed 5 and 10 year deals with us.
Oh, wow.
And they've needed more substantial space. They've really needed to build things out for testing. I mean, I'm sure you have the list, or we could send you the list of how diverse our 2,000 plus members are. I mean, you name a business and I will say, yes, they've been with us or they're currently with us. I mean, it's fascinating to see, you know, traditional business, sure, but all the startup interesting businesses that are happening within Ready Spaces is very cool. And, you know, we love to see what's going on and who knows what their success might be. I mean, part of our success is to see companies either stay with us and really grow, but they don't need more space. But many, you know, when they're really rolling, will certainly find conceivably bigger space. I would say some of our business is quasi-incubator, you know. Some of it's startup on one end, and on the other end, when you're rolling, you very well could need go from, you know, 5,000 to 50,000 square feet, and, you know, off they go. And to us, that's a success, of course.
So what are the terms of the leases other than duration? Because you're giving space, to begin with, a Fortune 500 company that signs a 5 or 10 year lease, I assume you have cost escalators in there? And by that, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm using the right terminology, but over the course of 10 years, you want the right to be able to raise the rent.
Oh, of course. It's all...
That's built into it.
Oh, of course. That's
and
all.
What about... That's all. What about...
By the way, that's also built into the lease that... or the rental agreement that everyone signs.
Yes. I mean, yeah. If it's going to be longer term, then you got to have that as part of it. Sure. But what about, I'm moving in 250 square feet,
yeah.
but I'm going to expand to 500, 1,000, and back down it's kind of the squeeze boxing. It's up and it's down. So each time I contract or expand, is there must be some kind of TI cost in there?
There is. We don't pass that along to you. And let me be perfectly frank. These are things that happen at the start of the leasing process in any particular building, that type of flexibility. We are so popular right now. We have waiting lists at virtually every location. We encourage our on-site facility managers to really sit down with people and discuss a bit of their vision and where they are and what they do. Because as I was a facility manager for years on my own, I would really get an understanding of what is this particular group attempting to do to steer them into the right size unit to begin with. Because here's what's happened. And again, maybe early on, there was more time and flexibility. But since we've picked up momentum, since this huge shift in the economy and the number of new businesses that are starting, I mean, we're just trying to play catch up to the demand. And so
there's money on the table right now. There's demand that you can't meet, and there's not enough facilities for you to sign a master lease with and then sublease out the space. Is that what's going on?
Basically, if you look at almost every one of our current locations, if we had something down the street, we could virtually double in size. If I could take my 132,000 square foot warehouse in Van Nuys and double the footprint there, we would fill it up.
Go ahead.
Let me go back to my original premises. If someone's coming in who's just starting a business and they're not quite sure of the space and what they need, and they're like, we just want to start with 250. And I said, well, what is it that you're bringing in? And what are your projected sales and a bit of that? Because I can tell you now, in a month to 3 months, you will need double or triple the space by just looking at, having a conversation. I would recommend that you go and do 750 square feet. And they're like, well, that's a little too expensive. And I'm like, here's the real expense. The real expense is if you have to move out because you've picked the wrong unit size and we don't have anything for you, what's the cost of moving? And by the way, where are you going? I mean,
what's available?
What's available? That's a fun part of the business, is to sort of see what's new and interesting and what people are doing. And, we're going to base it on their data, but I'm always trying to warn people. I'm like, you have to think you're going to be successful. And who cares if it really costs you? I mean, in dollars and cents, it might cost you $500 more a month, but it's worth $1,500 more in 3 months. Because again, what's it going to cost you?
Right. It's almost like an insurance policy.
In a way.
Yeah.
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 I mean, we haven't been wrong often. I could tell you, most everyone is like, oh, thank goodness we got a bigger unit. Because most people don't even know, even, I want to say seasoned people, but if you're not really seasoned, what do you know about lifting a pallet jack, pushing it into a unit? Can you stack it? Can you not? How much is the aisle way in my own unit to get to my product, right? This is so new for so many people. That it's a little bit trial and error, and it's a whole lot better to have a lot more space to move things around than to be so crammed in that you can't get to your product. And you're
inefficient. Right. So how many U.S. states and countries are you operating in now?
States,
roughly,
I think 7 or 8, right? Because we're Eastern Seaboard. We're Texas, we're California, Portland, we're Oregon, Washington, and we're in Canada. So
you're North America.
Yes.
You're not overseas though, are you?
We are not. Not yet.
Okay. So, WeWork talks, I've heard figures about WeWork. where it's going to, you know, estimates as to what percentage of the office business it will control.
Mm-hmm.
Now, warehousing is huge. I mean, it's gigantic, and it's just exploding. So I don't know that you have ever done any projections like that. It sounds like you're spending your time trying to find more facilities and get the waiting list turned into cash.
Yes.
But having said that, what can you tell us about what you forecast as the future growth of this business? And it sounds like competitors are going to be very much in the offing. I mean, you've got some competitors now, I believe, but nothing at your scale.
No, we really dominate and have market share. The one competitor that I know of, they spend a lot of their time dealing with their own trucking business. And when they need more space, they take it back. When they don't, they sort of cut it up and they're willing to share space or, you know, rent it out. That's ironic. They follow our model a bit. They followed our color scheme a bit. They've taken a lot of our language and adapted it to their website. So we appreciate.
Why reinvent the wheel?
Absolutely. We love the flattery. The imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. So, you know,
what about that forecast? What kind of growth are you thinking?
Yeah,
not just ready spaces, but just when you start to get more serious competitors, as I'm sure you will.
Sure. Well, let me tell you why we don't have competitors now. The self-storage industry, as I described, just their model is built on a 5x10, basically across the country, right? 50 square feet is how they do all their pricing. Now, the warehouse, let's look at, be it small group of warehouses owned by a landlord or even a conglomerate or like Prologis or a Blackstone, they're not in the service business, right? They want me, a ready spaces, to sign a 20-year lease, and they've got basically a guaranteed check month after month. We then go on, you know, turn around and go try to find 100 customers, members to fill that, and people will rotate, you know, sort of in and out during the cycle of whatever amount of time we're in that particular facility. So it is a niche, and it's a very unique model. But I don't know landlords that love to corral 100 different users with some of them coming and going. And only on a month to paying them on a month to month basis. Again, I'm not suggesting that it won't grow. It will certainly grow more. There's certainly competition that will probably see it and come in. But for right now, I think I've really understood why we're sort of in this niche and the player that we are. Let's talk about growth, which is the question that you asked. You know, if we have shifted from a retail to an e-tail economy, and everyone is still, you know, wanting things to get shipped to their house, a direct-to-consumer marketplace, I mean, sky's the limit. Who knows what's who knows how big this could get? We are, I could tell you, pretty conservative, believe it or not, in how we go about picking locations. You know, our feasibility.
I was going to ask you about that. What about that? What about next markets? What kind of cities? What are the characteristics of cities or states, or particularly cities, that make you say that is a ripe market for facilities?
Yeah, it's so data driven. I mean, there's so much that goes into it, and you would be surprised why we're not in certain cities. If I'd mentioned them, you'd like, yeah, I mean, are you kidding? That's one of the biggest hubs in America. But there's a very clear reason why, and I'm not going to get into the details. I'll let my competitors try to figure out the marketplace.
And proprietary.
very much so. And it's a matter of pulling a lot of data from a lot of different sources. And there's some things that really continuously ring true, and that's where we'll open. You know, when we're certainly not in our infancy whatsoever, but when you're trying to build a real corporate you know, your first, call it 50 facilities are all corporate. You want them all to be home runs, right? You just want them all to really succeed, because we will soon enough be going into the franchise business. And then we will happily support people who are interested in franchising our model. And then, you know, then we could divulge how we get to the information and feasibility and due diligence that is necessary. But, you know, we're not big on taking risk in quote unquote secondary or tertiary markets. Not right now. And we don't have to be, you know, we're not beholden to, you know, any sort of corporate or any sort of pressure from up above to hit numbers. And I think we're just going about this in a, I think, a very smart and organic fashion. We will see how we develop. And a lot of it, we do a lot of pre-marketing. I will say that. It's very interesting to hear from different parts of the country, people that have heard about us and want our services. And they say, hey, when are you coming to such and such? And then we start to look and we're like, is there really a market there? And we want to be at a certain size because there's economy of scale for us. And so, you know, there's secret sauce. I'll keep it to myself. We will see, you know, again, how just the economy itself sort of absorbs what this huge transition is that we're seeing now with especially this retail. This retail to e-tail is fascinating. E-commerce. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, once my mother at 80 was like, oh, I'm ordering all this stuff from Amazon directly to the house. And I'm like, oh, that's it. If an 80-year-old is getting things directly to her home and she's very active and goes out and like the shop and all that stuff, but the convenience, oh boy, the convenience.
Yeah. And I think people learn, especially more senior people and paranoid people. Not everybody who's paranoid or is a senior. There's still a lot of people, or there were a lot of people who thought, I'm going to get my credit card stolen, when in fact you're much more at risk just having it delivered in the mail. But the pandemic really drove people online and they'd had to start ordering. And I think a lot of them are completely hooked now.
Well, are you hooked?
Oh, I've been doing it for a long time. I'm hooked. I still go to stores. I like to go to stores, and oftentimes when you order online, you just go to the local Best Buy outlet or Home Depot or wherever, and you just pick it up. But it's easy to order, and you don't have to go to a store. The other part of it I like, frankly, John, is that, you know, it's frustrating to go to a store looking for something and it's not there. Instead, it tells you right there whether or not it's in inventory, and you can order it, and then they let you know, hey, it's here, come get it. Or you can pay to have it delivered to your home, whatever you want to do. So there you have it.
Exactly.
So I have you quoted here in a news release after you did your latest fundraising round, saying each Ready Spaces location acts as an incubator for small business entrepreneurship. So this whole pandemic thing, you also refer to that we're in the middle of a renaissance period for small businesses. So, you know, the other aspect of this, and I've said this on some other podcasts, that I think the pandemic, especially early on when people weren't sure how deadly this was, it just pushed into everybody's face that their mortality. And I think they started asking themselves, am I really doing with my life what I want to be doing? And a lot of them, the answer was no. And they decided, I'm going to, you know, who knows how long I'm going to be around. I might as well do what I want to do now. And the heart's still beating and I still have youth and vigor. So you're doing here. And then the whole, the e-tailing, starting businesses, and you know, there's a lot of businesses that have fallen out. So it's almost this creative destruction is going on. And now I think what we're going to see, I mean, look at the restaurant business. There were a lot of restaurants that were barely hanging on that probably needed to be flushed out of the firmament. But now you're going to have an explosion of new concepts coming into the restaurant business and in every other kind of business. So not surprising that we're seeing all these entrepreneurs kicking it into gear.
It's amazing. It's so cool to see. I mean, the ghost kitchen world is fascinating to me because restaurants, I mean, if you had a $50,000 a month nut to crack in a restaurant and your margins on food is only 15% to begin with, you have to rely exclusively on alcohol sales, right? That's the restaurant business by and large.
Right.
Not fast food, but traditional restaurant. You have to sell booze. Now you can make greater margins by taking your whatever your 5,000 square foot restaurant, you could shrink it into 500 square feet or even 250 square feet in a ghost kitchen. And Uber Eats and all the rest of the delivery people are making your deliveries. And now you're making larger margins with food. And I mean, and you don't even have to worry about alcohol sales any longer.
Yes. I mean, although you can have that there too, I would imagine, because you're actually in somebody's apartment or home or whatever.
Yeah. But the fact is that if restaurants are able to make money on food, which they almost never do, now they do. It's just amazing. Let me just give you a small.
It opens that margin up.
Let me give you an idea of a small example or a recent example. Someone that, again, she had a 2,000 square foot retail t-shirt, you know, sort of branding company, logo company. Pandemic comes. City forces her to close, right? We are an essential business. She moves her company in to our space. So she's literally going again from a couple thousand, 2,500 square feet down to, I think, 500 square feet. She finally went online. She was never online, but retailers, mostly small businesses, they rely on a customer walking through the door. They really weren't, most weren't actively marketing online. So she is forced literally and let out of her lease because the landlord said, yeah, you can't pay rent and the city's shut you down. We'll let you go. She moves out of a retail space, moves into what I call e-tail, our e-tail wholesale space, goes online and starts killing it. She's making t-shirts for people all over the country now. I mean, her margins are booming because she took the step out of retail into a warehouse space. Because she thought she did, but she didn't really need foot traffic. But that's the old way of thinking. I mean, that's why malls were popular and maybe some are still are, you know, because you get foot traffic. But, you know, I think the world just such a dramatic shift when you weren't allowed to go to work, but you had other bills and, you're like, I could be online and be a part of the supply chain movement, even though there's some bottlenecking right now. But I think that's the writing on the wall. It's like, I can start my own business. I could hang out at home or maybe in this space and be a part of what is this burgeoning online industry. And I can carve out my own little niche.
You got it. Our guest has been John Zimmerman. He is founder and CEO of Ready Spaces. Co-warehousing is his game, and it's going very well, it sounds like. John, I really appreciate you taking the time coming on the program, explaining your model to us, and wishing you best of luck with your future endeavors with the company.
Mike, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure, and it's very exciting to be a part of this industry, especially right now. Thank you again.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.